Good morning, everybody. Thanks for being here this morning. My name is Toni Ann, and I'm a recovered bulimic and compulsive overeater. So I just wanted to start off by telling you a little bit about myself. I had a best friend when I was 14 years old, and I used to spend a lot of time at her house. Her parents owned a business, and they were gone a lot, so I would go over there, and we'd be left to our own devices. She had an 18-year-old sister, who was beautiful. She was such a beautiful girl, and she was a bulimic. And I can remember finding out for the first time she would eat and binge and stuff, and then she would go in the bathroom, and she had all these little tricks that she would do, and she would induce vomiting in herself. And my problem with food started way before I was 14 years old. I mean, very early on. I come from a home, as probably a lot of us would share, an alcoholic father who was barely at the functioning level, and my mom who supported that. So it wasn't an ordinary type of a home, an upbringing. And I used food to cope from an early age. I used food to cope, but you know, my father was not really functioning, and there was problems with money and finances in the house. So I never had like big treats or exciting things to eat. It was always like junky, starchy food. And as I got older, I started to binge on foods that became easy to get rid of. I don't know if anybody would, you know, do that. There's all types of tricks. But what we're going to talk about today is a lot of food behaviors, different food behaviors. So I started doing this behavior when I was 14 years old, binging and purging. And I was able to get down to like a normal size at that age. But then what happened is that the idea that I had control took over in my brain. And I would think that I could eat anything I want and then just get rid of it and not have the consequences of having that weight on my body. And what happened, unfortunately, is it didn't work. And the weight would start creeping up and creeping up. And the binging, and as I get older, the disease progressed, and the binging and the purging became more and more. Then I would think to myself, well, the vomiting wouldn't be enough. So let me do laxatives now. And I started playing around with the laxatives and trying to get it. If I felt like I couldn't get it all up this way, let me get it out the other way. And I started playing with laxatives at a young age. I can remember when they had that. Oh, it was the best. It was the chocolate flavored Dexatrim, laxative, whatever that was. And I can remember eating that and thinking to myself like, oh, it tastes good too. Hang on a second. Change the view. And I can remember that. And that was... Anyway, that's how I started off, and that didn't work either. And unfortunately, all my attempts to control my weight, it still wasn't working no matter what I was doing. And I mean, the big book talks about sordid places, and I can tell you that I've done some pretty disgusting things when it comes to my bulimia, being desperate to get the food out of my body, grabbing a plastic bag and going outside and just getting rid of it, dumping that into dumpsters, stopping into gas stations in the most disgusting bathrooms. It's just really sad what I did. I can remember coming home from holidays, like, whew, that was a binge and purge, like it was like the marathon. And I can remember I had taken a whole bunch of laxatives, and it didn't hit me until I was driving home when I had my two babies. I was by myself with two babies in the car. And the only place that I could think of to stop that was open that I found, it was like a rural area. It was a bar. It was like this really seedy bar. And I left my kids in the parking lot on a holiday in this seedy bar that was packed with people. And I went in there to use the bathroom because I had no choice. I'm not proud of the things that I've done and where this disease has brought me. And it's not something I really talk a lot about in the rooms. I talk more about the compulsive overeating thing, and more so than the bulimia stuff. But I think it's really important that it is talked about. And I think that these food behaviors, we all have different food behaviors that we've done. We'll start talking about it a little bit later, but we'll find out that even though all of our behaviors were different, there's one thing here that binds us. And I just want to turn to the big book. If we were to open up our big book and turn to page 17, I'm going to read a little bit from this chapter. It's "There is a Solution." And it says, "We are average Americans. All sections of the country and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds." We're talking about the fellowship. "We are people who normally would not mix. but there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness and an understanding which is inexplicably wonderful. We are like passengers of a great liner the moment after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie and joyousness and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. Unlike the feelings of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual way. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement that binds us. And I just want to point that out because I'm in a program here of mostly compulsive overeaters. And a lot of people, you know, they're bound by the weight they lost or how big they were. And so, and sometimes as a bulimic or a person that perhaps I haven't gained that much weight or gained or lost that much weight, or perhaps I needed to gain weight when I came in here. And oftentimes I could feel like, well, I don't know how I could relate to this program because I'm different. I'm not like all of these other people. You know, I don't have to lose 100 pounds, or, you know, I have to gain weight. How could this program help me? How could I be related to this program? The book says, but that in itself would never have held us together as we are joined now. See, I didn't realize for a long time that it's not so much the symptom that binds us here in this program. What binds me here in this program is actually the solution. It goes on to say, the tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution, a way out on which we could absolutely agree, and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news that this book carries for us. So what binds us in Overeaters Anonymous is not how we come in. It's not the different things or the actions that we've done. What binds us here is that there is one solution for all of these problems and all of these behaviors that I have practiced over the years. And I'm just gonna, I'm gonna enumerate some of these behaviors. So I think it's important that we talk about behaviors. The definition of abstinence, first of all, is beautifully defined in OA, recently sent out again by World Service, is the act of refraining from compulsive eating and compulsive food behaviors while working towards or maintaining a healthy body weight. And I love that they did that in World Service because it meant so much more inclusion for somebody like me or somebody that perhaps they don't have, like I mentioned before, all of that weight to come in and feel like, well, this isn't going to help me. You know, so it allows us to have those food behaviors, to recognize that we have food behaviors. Some of those food behaviors are perhaps you might have done some of these things. That's why you're here today. Counting calories, vomiting, over-exercising, taking laxatives, restricting, not eating at all, only eating certain foods, only eating at certain times, not eating in front of anybody else, chewing and spitting, gum chewing, or body dysmorphia. And I'm sure that as we go on and you begin to share, is that you can add more of those behaviors, but those are the ones that came to my mind this morning. So what are we going to do about it? So what happened to me is I spent a lot of time focusing on myself, my appearance, and what I thought everybody thought about me. So much time on that. And I always thought that if I just looked better, then somebody would want me enough to save me. I was convinced that if I was just good enough, somebody would take care of me and I wouldn't have to worry. Yes, it must go all the way back to when I was growing up and I never felt like I was safe and secure in my home. And I wanted so badly just to be safe and secure. I wanted somebody to make me feel like that. And I felt like if I could just be better, then perhaps that could happen. Perhaps that could happen. On page 52 in the big book, the Bedevilmen say, we were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Well, I certainly couldn't be of real help to anybody else because I was so focused on myself. How could I be of help to anybody else? All I thought about was myself. And it's not, you know, it's not that I thought too much of myself or I thought too little of myself. My problem is that I think of myself too often. Self-centeredness, that is my problem. Okay, so Big Book also says, on page 13, my friend had promised when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my creator, that I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all of my problems. Belief in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were the essential requirements. Simple, but not easy. A price had to be paid. It meant the destruction of self-centeredness. So in my self-centeredness, I can tell you, I created so much wreckage, and I did so much damage to so many relationships in my life and so many people in my life. I was so focused on getting what I wanted and what I needed and thinking that I can control things. And I really do believe that this is a disease of control. And I just thought that if I can control my food, if I can control how I looked, I would control what you thought about me. And then, of course, I can control how other people acted. And then everything would be good because you would all be running by my script, which would be great. And of course, how did that work out for me? It did not work out very good for me at all. What happened was the people around my life, they rebelled against my script, or they did their own thing because I have no control over it. So how do I get from that to where I am today? Well, when I was in enough pain and I created enough wreckage, I found this program. I found this program by, I was doing a, you know, the point of excessive exercise. I had agreed to do a 60-mile walk for charity because, of course, that's what I do. And if I walked 60 miles, I knew I was going to lose weight. So I agreed to do this and I was training for it. During the training process, we were raising money. The group I was with couldn't raise the money. So I sent a letter out to the editor asking for help. And the woman that responded to the letter gave money to my group. I asked her, long story short, she came out on a walk. We're walking around and she asked me if I had breast cancer and why am I doing this? And I said, well, you know, I'm trying to lose weight. And she said to me, oh yeah, I used to worry about my weight a lot too, but now I eat 3 weighed and measured meals with nothing in between. And then she told me about OA. And that was how I found my way here. Of course, I didn't come right away because I still thought, oh, I'm running the show. I'm going to walk this weight off and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. All the things that I tried. And none of those things ever worked. And none of those things ever made me happy either. You know, I'm just not happy when I'm stuck in myself. So self-centeredness, that is the root of my problems. I'm focused on myself. So how do I get out of that? What do I do with that? Well, first of all, before I could even get out of that, I needed to know what it is. Before I could fix my problem in this program, I needed to understand what my problem was. So when I read the doctor's opinion, it tells me that I have a twofold problem. I have a mental obsession and I have an allergy of the body. I have an obsession of the mind and an allergy of the body. So it's really weird. Like if I'm not an overeater, what is my allergy? Then what is my allergy? Well, I think in order to understand what the allergy is, we need to define what that word actually is. An allergy is an abnormal reaction to a substance or thing. So what is an allergy I have if I don't eat? What is the allergy I have? Well, perhaps the allergy that I have is to the high that I get by unthinking that I can control. It's the hit that comes from thinking that I can control something that other people can't. It was a feeling of superiority when inside I felt inferior. I don't know if that makes sense to anybody, but that's what I believe the allergy is. The allergy is thinking that I can control things that are uncontrollable. The allergy is to adrenaline, that adrenaline. So how do I separate myself from that? How do I turn that off, that hit that I'm getting? That's a really difficult thing. And I think that's one of the biggest struggles that we have here with these food behaviors and program. How do I get rid of it? Well, I also think that underneath a lot of that is fear. And what is the fear, as I mentioned before? The fear that I have is that I'm not good enough, or that you're not going to want me, so that you're not going to fix me, and that I'm not going to be good enough by myself to do this thing that I can't. I'm not going to get what I want, in short. I'm not going to get what I want. And what do I want? I don't want to do anything. So I want you to take care of me. And I want life to be easy. I want it to be easy. And I want you to do it. And I want it just to be easy for me. Or I don't want you to find out that I'm a fake inside. I look good on the outside, but inside I'm a disaster. And I don't want anybody. That's my fear. Not being found out, not getting what I want, or losing what I think I have, a sense of control or a sense of identity. Because look at me, everybody. I'm the thinnest person in the room. Well, I come to find out in program that the thinnest person in the room is not mean the healthiest person in the room. That's for sure. I've learned that story before. So what do I do about this? It meant the destruction of self-centeredness. I didn't even know what self-centeredness was. I remember when I did the steps with my sponsor and she said to me, "You're egotistical." I was like, she could have slapped me. I swear to God. She could have taken like a human head and pulled it out. And I would have been like, what do you mean I'm egotistical? And she's right. And the only reason that I was able to hear it from her when she told me that I was egotistical is because I know for a fact that she says that she's egotistical also. She's egotistical also. So self-centered, I'm going to give you a couple of definitions here this morning. Self-centered means, you ready for this? Being preoccupied with oneself and one's affairs, engrossed in self, fixed. Isn't that interesting? It means fixed or unchanging. In other words, being stuck. How many times have I been stuck, unable to do what I needed to do? Like I wanted to do it, but I just couldn't because I'm stuck. Now that's because I'm self-centered. I'm going to give you a couple other definitions here. Selfishness. The definition of selfishness means wanting people to stick to my script. And the definition of self-seeking are the actions I take to get my own way. The secret manipulation. The actions I take to get my own way. So if selfishness, self-seeking, and self-centered are my problem, what am I supposed to do about that? Right? So I came in here thinking that food was my problem or you were my problem, you know? But this program tells me that I'm the problem. The problem is the 6 inches between my ears. That is the problem. What am I supposed to do about that? Well, the beautiful thing is that we have these 12 steps that actually helps us. Now, years ago, there were, when they wrote this book in 1930s, there were psychologists and they were as smart and psychologists that were as smart as they are today. And they knew that what people needed to do in order to get overcome this problem. But there was a thing that they didn't know was how to apply it. It's actually in the big book. I'm going to read it to you. It's in a doctor's opinion. If you were to turn to the doctor's opinion on page 27, and if anybody wants any of these references, they can talk to me afterwards. On page 27 or XXVII, it says, "We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology, was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception." So what that means is that they knew that they needed to do this thing called moral psychology. I'm going to define it in a second. But what they didn't have was an application to administer it. So let me just tell you, imagine that we get a vaccine for the coronavirus, okay? We're going to get a vaccine, but they don't know how to distribute it. That would be the problem. Is it going to be orally? Is it going to be a shot? Is it, is it going to be something you put on your skin, a topical? So that was the problem that these doctors had. They knew what the solution was, but they didn't know how to give it to the patient. And then it goes on to say about with their ultra-modern standards or scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well-equipped to apply the powers of good that lies outside our synthetic knowledge. Synthetic knowledge is the things that you know based on your experience. So let me just tell you what moral psychology is. It's a real thing back in the 1930s. It actually means the study of moral identity development or how people integrate moral ideas with the development of their own characters. So it is how people integrate moral ideals with the development of their own character. So how do we change what we believe is true and good and bad and true and false? Well, beautiful thing is that there's these men that got together and they figured out a way. It was called it started from the Oxford group. It's the 12 steps. So in the 12 steps, what it does is it actually helps me to change my ideals, what I believe and what I think, so that I get out of this self-centeredness and I go from living a self-centered, selfish life to living a life where I'm God-centered or focused on you. Because I'm powerless over changing this by myself. I cannot fix myself. I need a power that's going to fix me. And what I do is I work this program and I don't have to start out having a power to work this program. I'm going to tell you that I find the power by working the program. I'm going to say it again. I find this power by working the program. So if you're sitting here today or you're listening to this recording and you say to yourself, well, I don't know. I don't know about God. I don't believe in God. It doesn't matter. If I work this process, it'll be revealed to me in through working this process what that power is. Let's just move on a little bit. And so how do I do that? First of all, I have to trust something, right? So in step one, I admit that I have a problem. Well, that's easy enough. It's usually obvious when I'm coming in that I have a problem. But in step two, I look at all these people around me and I have to believe that there is an answer to it. And it's kind of hard when my food behaviors are different than other people. Because in the rooms, there's a lot of talk about losing weight and putting down the food and stuff. And what if I'm a person that needs to eat more food, right? So I've been talking to a bunch of people about this because I'm not an anorexic. And I know that there's going to be people that are listening to this that are anorexic. And I talked to another person, another friend in program who does the chews and spits. And I said to her, like, what was the one thing that was pivotal for you in helping you? She's recovered. What was the one thing that helped you recover? And what she said to me was she finally got a sponsor that had the same problem. And that made the huge difference. And she, when her sponsor said to her, you're going to have 4 tablespoons of oil today. And she said, oh, no. No human should eat 4 tablespoons of oil. How could I eat 4 tablespoons of oil? And her sponsor said to her, I'm eating 6 today. And when she looked at her sponsor was beautiful. And she thought to herself, okay, if this woman is doing it, then I can do it. And I have to tell you that I do have a sponsor that is bulimic today. And I really do feel like we have that bond, you know, because we understand each other. We understand what it feels like to want to, you know, I could eat a salad and not want to keep that in my body. So we have that understanding. And in this program, you will find the people that you need. And it may not be as simple as, you know, being a compulsive overeater where it's abundant and there's so many sponsors. You might have to look a little bit, but we are around the world and there are always people that are going to have that same problem as me because I am not as unique as I think I am. I am not as special as I think I am. There is always somebody else that does what I do or have done things that are worse than me. So I found this sponsor and I worked through the steps as they're written in the big book. And in step two, I came to believe that something could happen, could work for me. But the thing about believing is, I don't think believing is important. I think believing is underrated. Overrated. I think what's underrated is trust. Believing is overrated and trusting is underrated. And they're closely related. I mean, they're close to each other. And I'm going to talk a little bit about trust. I have this book. I don't know if it's program approved, so I won't mention it. But in this book, it says trust in many forms and areas may be the biggest issue facing us in recovery. And I know that as a bulimic or as an anorexic, you know, I don't want to trust that if I eat this, I'm going to be okay. Or if I stop doing this, I'm going to be okay. Or people are telling me, come on, you have to. And I don't want to trust what anybody's saying. I only know what I know. Trust in many different forms and areas may be the biggest issue facing us in recovery. Trust, like surrender, has elements of being passive and of being active. It takes an opening or surrendering to our feelings and being vulnerable. So there you go. It takes an opening and a surrendering to my feelings and being vulnerable. My feelings are not going to kill me. I can feel something and get over it. I can have fear and do something anyway. I could not want to do something and do it anyway. Letting go of counting on results and instead surrendering to the process is what trust is about. So what I have to do is stop focusing on what I think is going to happen, what the results are, and focus on the process of doing the one day at a time thing, the one meal at a time, and sometimes even one bite at a time. If I can just focus on that process and let go of the result that I've got the death grip on, you know, let go of that. And just focus on doing the next right thing. That's when the miracle happens. So I asked my friend, the chewer, you know, what happened? You know, how were you? What was the pivotal moment? And she said to me, she decided one day that she was going to swallow her entire breakfast. And that's how it started. She swallowed an entire breakfast. And it was scary, but she did it. And from there, she thought to herself, okay. I'm going to try to swallow my lunch. And that was how she was able to get recovered. And that's how it started. And when she started to eat, then she was able to work the steps. And when she worked the steps, she had a transformation in her life. And she realized that she didn't have to control everything like that. She no longer was running the show. And instead of being focused on self and self-centered, she began focused on God and on helping others, on helping God's children. How can I be useful today?
How can Five minutes, Tony.
Thank you. What can I do to be useful today? So in step three, I turn my life over, my will and my life over to God. And what does that mean? That means that I make a promise that I'm going to abandon myself, abandon my selfishness, and focus on working with others. And how do I do that? By getting to step 12. So in step three, it's just basically a decision to work these steps so that I can become useful in step 12. That's the fulfillment of step three. The fulfillment of our third step is in step 12, where now I've abandoned myself and my primary purpose is to help you. That is the primary purpose, to help me to let go of myself so that I can be happy, joyous, and free. All right, so being vulnerable. Let's talk about that for a second. How do I become vulnerable? Vulnerable means taking a chance. It means being brave when I'm afraid. It means doing things that perhaps other people are going to see that, guess what? I'm not perfect. And you know what? Here's what I learned. I learned that it's my imperfections that make me more attractive to people than my perfections. It's what's imperfect about me is what people actually get attracted to. They're my weaknesses, because people look at my weaknesses and say, wow, I'm just like her. I don't have to be perfect either. It's okay to not be perfect. It's okay to just be me. There are certain nations and cultures that actually weave in imperfections because it's so important. That's what keeps us close to our creator. So today, I remember somebody once said to me, I no longer strive for perfect. I just strive for excellent. And what is God's will for me? It's not to be perfect. It's to do the best that I can. To do the best that I can. In this program, we claim spiritual progress, not spiritual perfection. And progress is allowing myself to be vulnerable. And each time I allow myself to be vulnerable, I learn. And when I learn, I get closer. I get closer to God, away from myself. And I want to just talk a few minutes before I go and step two. There's a lesson in that story. It talks about the people in the past that didn't have progress like we have today. You know, they were fettered by their traditions and their superstitions. And what it really means is that one of my biggest problems is I'm prejudiced. And I never thought I was a prejudiced person. I wouldn't tell you that I was, but prejudice means that I am attached to my preconceived ideas without having the experience. And my ideas are going to be okay. If I eat that, it's not going to be okay. If I let go of who I am, I'm not going to be okay. And in order to work this program, I have to put down those prejudices. I have to be open-minded. And I have to just be willing to say, you could be right. Perhaps the way that I've been working and running my life hasn't been working. And if I try something different, you could be right. Maybe I'm going to get a different result. When I change my perspective, I get a different point of view. When I change my perception, I get a different point of view. I start to see things differently. Perhaps it's not that important that I'm perfect. Perhaps it's not that important that everybody loves me. No, I can just be me, who I am, and be authentic. And I think that that's really so important. I can be authentic and be happy, joyous, and free. And so what happened to me is I worked these steps exactly as they're written in the big book. I wrote an inventory. Thank you. I wrote an inventory. I look at my character defects. I continue. I made amends. I made a lot of amends. Direct or indirect, there's no living amends. Every amends is a living amends. The amends I made were either direct or indirect, but I made restitution. And that's important. And I allowed myself to be vulnerable. And then from there, every single day I work step 10. And through step 10, I work steps 11 and 12. I have conscious contact with God. And I ask myself that question, not what would I have myself be, but what would God have me be? What would God have me be? God would not have me hurt myself. And today I can tell you that food has become fuel. That's my time. Food has become fuel. It's not something that I have to be afraid of or control. And just in closing, I'm going to leave you guys with a prayer. And I actually put this prayer into the chat. Let me just find it 1 second. Here it is. Okay. I'm going to put it into the chat. Okay. If you'd like to have a copy of it. But here's the prayer. God, please destroy the lie that thinness and control will make me happy and secure. Help me believe the truth that in you alone is my happiness and security. And thank you. With that, I pass.